Welcome to American Italian Radio, where we explore the life of American Italian entertainers, storytellers, and artisans. There are 100 million Italophiles, people who like all things Italian, and our program is designed to share the American Italian heritage with all of you. We invite our guests to discuss their lives, their careers, and how their American Italian heritage has influenced them, and to tell us about their new projects. And now, let's join our hosts, Sal LaFerri and Don Mazzella.
Hello and welcome to the American Italian Radio Channel on Blog Talk Radio. You're listening to Air Radio, which is sponsored by Protective Countermeasures and by Deem.com. I'm Sal LaFerri, and I'm here with my co-host of Air Radio, Don Mazzella. In these hours with you, we highlight the culture, mores, experiences, and individuals that make up today's American-Italian world. Many of us share memories of growing up Italian, and we want to capture that as well as what is new and exciting and happening in our world today. We want to recall how our lives were growing up, what it means to be an Italian-American, and talk about how our culture helped build positive attitudes. To do this, we bring to our studio leaders in each of their respected fields, exchange memories growing up Italian, and explore how our culture helped them succeed. Through these guests, we want you to know more about the best of today's American-Italian culture. Our programs are also devoted to what's happening today by giving our guests the opportunity to share their stories and what they are doing. Along the way, we hope to generate a few laughs about the times as they were and as they are now. There are over 100 million American Italians and those who enjoy our culture. It is to these wonderful people that this show is dedicated. I mean, after all, aren't we all paisans? We want you to follow us on Twitter, friend us on Facebook, and find us on our website, theamericanitalianradio.com. We invite you to visit our website, share it among your friends. If you'd like to be a guest on the show or know a person who'd be interested in talking to us, please contact us through our website, AmericanItalianRadio.com. Today we have a guest. We actually had two guests. We're waiting for the second one to call in. But our guest today answers the following question. How can an Italian-American from Yonkers find happiness, keep alive her American heritage, and thrive in Seattle, 3,000 miles from her roots? Patricia Vaccarino met her Italian-American husband in Seattle, is active in cultural efforts, and runs a thriving PR business. We want to talk to her about her heritage and how it helped build success and infuse her family. But before we get to Patricia, I'd like to introduce my co-host and friend, Don Mazzella.
Good to be here, Sal. You know, it's spring. When a young man's fancy turns to what girls have been thinking about all winter. It's also the time when we start to think about gardens. I don't know about you, but my grandfather had a garden. Just about everybody in our neighborhood had a garden. What was it like? Was it a big deal in your neighborhood, gardens?
Well, I mean, for starters, when springtime comes, my thoughts very rarely go to tomatoes. They wind up going to women.
Yeah.
Because you see the women in short dresses and better outfits, but then they get rid of the winter coats. But, yeah, gardening was a big thing. My mom really got a big kick out of doing the garden. When we moved to the Bronx, we had a small backyard, and that was like living in the country. So she got to plant all of the things that she wanted to plant. And, I think I even wound up planting strawberries for 1 year. So it was fun.
Well, you know, my grandfather had a garden, and that was his love of his life. And I remember looking at it and watching it grow and bloom and watching him work in it. I mean, if you remember in the Godfather movie, that wonderful scene with the old Godfather with his two children in the garden.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Francis Ford Coppola said about that he really based that on his own grandfather and his own growing up. But I do know, heaven help you, as a young kid, if the ball went into that garden, trying to get that ball back. Oh my God! Did that happen with you?
Yeah, we used to have there was an older guy who lived a couple of doors down from us, a guy by the name of Firth, Mr. Firth.
And he would have, he had a yard that was actually photographed and in magazines. It was that good. And when we would play in front of the house, he would open up his garage door just a little bit so that if the ball went down the driveway, it would go into his garage and he would keep the ball. And he was there. I remember having to deal with him a couple of times. Although growing up in the Bronx, we had a few guys that weren't adverse to going, opening up the garage door and going to retrieve the ball, which always made for more fun stories.
You know, that's funny because we had the same type of guy in our neighborhood, and he kept the balls, you know, and at that time getting a ball, either a baseball or a rubber ball. You remember the high bouncer?
Pensy Pinsky.
Yeah.
I think it was the name of him. Pinkies? What the hell was it called? I don't remember Pinkies. But yeah, the Spalding's.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You remember, God, you had to save up for it. 5 cents you had to save up for your thing. Now when I look at all the equipment, I get jealous of these kids today. But, you know, it was really interesting. Gardens. I noticed this week, do you also remember how they used to cover the fig trees and put a paint bag on a paint pail
on the top?
On the top.
Yeah. There was actually an art to doing that.
Yes.
And if you did it wrong, you'd kill the tree.
Tree.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They used to take all of the leaves that would fall, and they would put the leaves sort of in the branches and kind of wrap it up with plastic. And they would, and then they would take the burlap sacks, mm-hmm. and wrap it in burlap. Or the other way around. I can't remember if it was burlap and then plastic and burlap. But either way, they would wrap the tree and it is huge monstrosity in the backyard for a while.
Hmm. But let's get on to our guest today.
Okay, our guest today. Well, we have Patricia Vaccarino. She lives in Seattle, has her own PR firm, is raising 3 children, and has an American-Italian husband. Patricia, are you with us? Patricia, you with us?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
Well, good morning. You're on
good
with
morning.
Sal and Don.
Yeah. Hi, Sal. Hi, Don.
Good to have you with us. I know you had to get up early to do the show.
Early. Yeah, it's just after 7 a.m.
Yeah. Patricia, you went to college in Rhode Island, worked in Pennsylvania, if I recall talking to you right. And
yep.
then... when you graduated, decided to go across country. Did
yep.
I get that right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, my last year of college, I went to work in the summer in the Poconos, and my father, Joe Vaccarino, was in the liquor business. And while I was in the Poconos, I worked as a cocktail waitress, and a lot of kids worked there in the summer, and we made quite a bit of money. So at the end of the summer, I decided to see America. So I was in a battered old Chevy Impala and made my way. I took Interstate 40, and in part that's the old Route 66. So I went through the whole southwest area and then came up the California coast and landed in Seattle.
What did you find about Seattle that you liked?
Well, you know, when I first got here, I didn't like it at all. And I couldn't get over the fact that, you know, everyone out here, they thought I was from a foreign country. I guess my accent was so strong. I had such a heavy New York accent. People would always ask me, where are you from? And they never thought I was from the U.S. I mean, they thought I was from Scandinavia. I had people ask me if I was from Germany. I mean, there was, like, such a complete cultural difference between Seattle and the East Coast. And that was all pre-Microsoft, so the area has changed radically since then. It's become a lot more integrated with people from all over the country. Microsoft brought a lot of talent in, and you know, not only from the whole country, but really globally. And so the city's grown up a lot since I've been here. But I have to say, when I first got here, I really didn't like it very much. I thought it was, you know, like a small town, and it had a very provincial feel, and there wasn't really a downtown area, and it was before a lot of the construction boom took place in the city, and before it grown has to the extent that it's reached now.
Well, what made you stay?
Well, at that time I was going into law, and I figured whatever law school I got into, that would dictate where I would stay. So I applied to schools all over the country, really, and the schools were comparable. And so I just decided to stay and go to school. And then one thing led to another, and I didn't stay in law school. And I was writing. I was writing professionally. I was writing articles and scripts, and mainly like commercial scripts and for documentaries, corporate films. And I was asked by a production company to start doing their PR. And so it was just completely by just a sheer twist of fate. I never really thought about it as a profession. And the company was K. Smith Productions, and it was the largest commercial film production house north of San Francisco. And it was founded by Lester Smith, who was a Seattle businessman. He used to own the Seattle Mariners, and he was a media mogul. And Danny Kaye, that's the Hollywood Hoofer. They had formed a production company, and the company made mainly television commercials. So that was my start in PR.
Well, if I recall, you said you met your husband there in the market area.
Yeah, it's kind of funny because most men that I dated or went out with, the way I talk, I guess being a New Yorker and being of Italian American descent, just the way I speak, they think that I'm fighting with them. But another Italian male, an Italian male gets that's just the way I am. So and finds it kind of enjoyable. And besides that, I'm an awesome cook.
Yeah.
So.
Oh well, we're going to get into that, but let's address that. What were the differences between dating a Seattle man and then Italian American? What were the differences?
Well, I think that Italian men are more they're more. How should I say, more submissive to women in some ways. They really put a woman on a higher level in respect. That's what I always found. For example, when I was growing up in New York, my father, I'll go back to that. My father wanted to see me educated. He wanted to see me with a great profession. There weren't any barriers that I was regarded in a way that I should have less because I was a woman. And ironically, my husband's very much the same way. He loves to talk about business with me. We share a lot of conversations about what's going on in the economy. And, we're always communicating to one another in a way that, we're talking about the nature of the world and ideas and issues and innovation. And my father was the same way, and that's the big difference that I noticed. That both men, the major figures in my life, my husband and my father, they shared a great deal of similarity. And here's a real coincidence: both of them are named Joe, both of them have blue eyes, both of them served in the military. My father served on the front lines of Korea, and my husband, did a tour in Vietnam. And they're just very similar to one another in their temperament. So who knows? Maybe that's how I would characterize them.
Well, that's interesting. Both you and your husband are children of Italian fathers and Irish mothers. Am I right?
Yes, that's correct. Yeah.
They say you marry your mother or you marry your father, but. Do you think there's anything to that?
Yeah, I think that, there's an old adage that you spend the second half of your life getting over what happened to you when you were raised as a child. So I think that the spouses we choose are very much, part of that psychological imprinting that we have when we're growing up, and either that we choose someone who's very similar or a reaction to that.
So do you miss being back on the East Coast?
Well, I travel back very frequently, and I have a lot of clients in New York City. And I started going back to New York. I was in-house with a client for a year, Tim Gervin, who's a renowned designer and branding expert. And he does all the movie title design work that comes out of Hollywood, like Paramount or Warner Brothers. And he had an office down in the Flatiron District. So in 2005, I started traveling to New York with, you know, every 6 weeks. And I thought, why did I leave? You know, I just fit culturally more in New York. And then the way business is done, it's such a much more rapid pace than it is in Seattle. And with that, when I started building my own business, you know, at a higher, at an accelerated rate, what happened at that time, I started going back to New York on that schedule every 6 weeks. And I would fly in, you know, I would get in on Monday morning and fly home on Thursday. And during the downturn, you know, the climate has changed a little bit, so I'm not going back to New York with as great a frequency. I was back last month, and I was back in November. And right now, because of the projects that I'm working on, I won't be returning until November. And at that time, I'll be putting on a large networking event in Midtown. So I have a lot of, I would say I have as many clients in New York City as I do the rest of the country. So,
what do you consider home?
New York. It'll always be my home, you know, no matter where I live. In fact, you know, I live in Seattle, but my husband and I own another home down on the Oregon coast in a town called Manzanita, which is just 20 minutes south of Seaside. And even as much as I love being there, I mean, being on the Pacific Ocean, you know, we have an incredible view that goes down 50 miles down the coast. And even with that, you know, I love the West Coast, but, you know, New York City, that's home.
New York is home.
Tell us about growing up in Yonkers.
Everyone was Catholic or Jewish. And I didn't know what a WASP was until I moved to the West Coast, until I was like, you know, I didn't know what the acronym stood for. And I didn't know that there was anything else in the world, you know, that people are much more aware of their ethnicity in New York. And I remember the old, you know, there was an old Italian neighborhood, and there was the Irish neighborhood, and then right adjacent to that, there was the Polish neighborhood. And there was a real sense of where we had come from. There was still much more of an identity, you know, that we, a lot of our ancestors came in through Ellis Island, and that whole melting pot, I found that was very much part of my childhood, and that I knew so many people from so many different kinds of ethnic backgrounds, not only being Italian. I mean, I had a very strong Italian identity, and with my grandparents, and my father was very proud of being Italian, and that was very rooted, and there was a work ethic, a real credo, a sense of that we took care of one another, that there was it dominated the way we did business, or the way I do business today, in that, you know, I help you, you help me, and we all rise together. So that was, I think, still part of the whole immigrant mentality. And I find when I go back to New York, even today, I still find very much that that's how people do business. That they expect, you know, if you help someone, that they know that they're going to take care of you. And I don't see that on the West Coast as much.
Well, let's explain that WASP means White Anglo-Saxon Protestant.
Right, not the bug.
I happen to be married to one. So, who, by the way, speaks better Italian than I do. But that's another story.
Good Italian. Yeah.
You also cook well. But before we do that, who most influenced you growing up?
My father. Yeah, my father was a tremendous influence on my life. And Yeah, it's something that, you know, it brings, my father's passed away now, so I wrote a novel, which is kind of like a thriller, because I write books as a hobby, and I've written two business books, but this was a thriller, and it was kind of a tongue-in-cheek, what if, it was about a woman who was suited to take over the family business. And the family business was one of those businesses that we all know, right, those who know. And her father wouldn't let her take over the business because she was a woman. And there are no women mafia dons in America. They are in Sicily. You know, when their husbands go to jail, they continue to run the business. But not in America. So I wrote this book called One Small Murder, and it was about this whole story about a woman who wasn't allowed to take over the family business, but in the end her father does concede that she is the best person for the job. So it's meant to be a series, and the next one she actually does come back to New York and takes over the family business and then finds out that a lot of the traditional mafia has now kind of, it's declined. And a lot of, you know, many more businesses have gone legitimate, you know, and the sons and daughters of people who were, say, connected to the mafia or had mafia roots, all those young people have gone on and they're, you know, they're bankers and lawyers and physicians, legitimate business people.
Has it been published?
Yes, yeah, it's online. You can get it on Amazon.
Oh, what's the title? Yeah.
One Small Murder.
All right.
So that's what I do for a hobby. You know, I'm passionate about writing. I do a lot of ghostwriting in my business and PR. I write articles and blogs and, you know, all kinds of things for clients. And then so when I get time, let's just say that I make the time, I write books.
Nah.
And I would never give up my business to write full time. I like that it's a hobby.
Where did that bug come from?
Pardon me?
Where did the bug come from about writing, about wanting to write? Was it something as a child you enjoyed writing, or is it something you saw as a vehicle for business?
Yeah, I started writing very early on. I was one of those kids where the nuns would pull me aside after I'd submit a composition, and they would say, "Did you really write this? did you find it somewhere?" You know, it was a strong talent from the time I was a little kid. And when I started writing, you know, that's what I wanted to do professionally. I wrote screenplays. I back in the 80s, I had some connections in Hollywood. And the scripts that I wrote, though, were corporate films. They weren't feature films. I did write feature films, but on spec. And so something was always with me, and I found that good, strong writing was definitely a requirement for having a good PR business. And, you know, sometimes I'll see these things come out from, you know, different PR entities, PR University or something, and they'll say that, why can't PR people write well? Well, frankly, they shouldn't be in the business if they can't write well, because in order to be, you know, to do effective messaging for your clients, you know, to create good content for your clients, you know, you have to be a good writer. Now, the writing creatively, you know, even coming up with story ideas for in order to pitch to press, that you should have that creative component of your personality.
You know, I'm editorial director of a group of newsletters and a magazine, and the funny part about it is what you say about poor writing. Mm-hmm. And believe me, what comes across my desk sometimes really scares me.
Yeah.
It really does.
Yeah, I'm not surprised. I mean, I've seen a ton of it, and then now because there's so much, you know, people are blogging. I always advise a client, for example, when it comes to blogging, I always say, do you really want to commit to this? Because there isn't anything to me that's sadder than an abandoned blog. And the last data that I looked at from Technorati indicated that 90% of all blogs are abandoned. So it's, yeah, anybody can go out there and start babbling about something, but, you know, the quality of good writing, that should be your primary interest if you want to generate that kind of content.
For somebody that's starting a business and is going to get into the social media realm.
Mm-hmm.
What's more important? And I don't mean stuff that you can't read. I mean, clearly we're talking about, you know, some level of, you know, being able to communicate effectively with the pen. But what's more important? Is it that they should be writing or that they should become I'm going to go on a limb and say that of the 90%, probably a majority of them are intimidated that what they're putting out is going to be read by someone else.
Right.
So how do you get somebody, I guess the real question to you is, how do you get somebody over that hurdle where they're able to write and they got to, you know, get away from that block? How do you deal with that?
That's a great question. And the first thing I would look at is going back to the essential element of defining who you are. And some people would call that personal branding, and I call it reputation management. I mean, personal branding sounds a little too fluffy for me, so I would go back and say, look at your reputation. Who are you? You know, what are your core attributes? But more importantly, the question is, what do you stand for? So for this beginning person going out there, I would say always run everything by that test, that question. What do you stand for? If you know what you stand for, then you're not going to make a mistake about what you put out there, because it's always going to go by that litmus test to find out, you know, the core, you know, because included in that question, what do you stand for, that's everything about you. It's your ethnicity, it's your history, it's your background, it's your religion, it's your education, it's your sense of ethics, your integrity, you know, your leadership. So everything is rolled into that question. So that's the would be very helpful, I think, for anyone going out there. And then they can feel pride about what they are posting or what they are tweeting about and not feel that they've made a mistake, because everything is, again, going through that test.
And then they just got to get over the hurdle of being able to write it and post it.
Yeah. Well, one way that my business is a little different, when we because we integrated social media a long time ago, and for clients, I work with them to think strategically about how they're integrating their social media platforms. For example, to write out all their tweets for a month. And this isn't to say that they're just, you know, it's just like headline material, but they're thinking about what the content that they are putting out there. And this way that they don't have to struggle to come up with something at random every day. But at least if they feel like getting up in the middle of the night and posting something at random, they can do that. But when you have, say, 30 tweets written out for the month or for the, you know, next 6 weeks, it gives you a sense of, you know, how do those tweets fit in with the other things you're writing, you know, the other things that you're sending out to the press, you know, to the other things you're sending out to your community, you know, so there's a theme to the tweets. And there's a theme, you know, for their other work or the other information, the other content that they're sending out. So it's not random, that it's very strategic. And so that's what I would say to get over that, to experiment by just putting it down on paper and taking a look at it and then doing that at the beginning of the month. And then this way you know exactly, you know, what kind of information you're going to be transmitting over a schedule, over a period of time.
What do you think about on Twitter going on, I'm relatively new to all of this, so I'm, and I'm sure a lot of people out there are in the same boat. Twitter has this advertising program where you can either get more followers or push a product or a service.
Right.
What's your opinion about that?
I think it's a waste of time, and the reason why is when you're building a Twitter following, you have to approach it as though you're building a community. And so you're building that community around who you are or your products or your services. That means when I say a community, I define it as a community of interest. Other people who get value from what you have to say. So you have to build your following organically. And that means going out and researching and seeing who else is out there and then follow them and follow their followers and follow the people who they're following. And more often than not, they'll follow you back. So that's how you build your following organically. I mean, there are a number of different ways that you can search on Twitter, you know, by hashtag searches or searching for people who you know who are on Twitter. And that there are services where you can go out and buy followers. I call them herders, herding services. But what advantage is that? It'll pump up your numbers. And if you want to give the perception that you just have a lot of followers, then you can go out and pay, you know, for followers. But it's not a real community. And it's never, you're never going to increase clients or customers or sell product or sell books or move mountains by going out there and getting fake followers.
Well, Patricia, we're going to take a short break right now, but when we come back, what I'd really like to chat with you about is continue this conversation about Twitter, but more importantly, talk to you about when you have all of these followers and people you're following, how the hell do you get time to be able to read and put up with all of this? Because it seems like it's a full-time job.
Yeah.
So when we come back, I want you to answer that big question for me.
Sure. Be happy to.
We'll be right back.
Okay.
Just how dangerous is social networking? Use of websites like Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube are all the rage. But what are the downsides of this new technology? The incidence of bullying, stalking, harassment, and inappropriate content are increasing. Just how dangerous is it? What can you do to protect your child and yourself from it? Go to ProtectiveCountermeasures.com for a free hour-long video on the dangers of social networking. That's ProtectiveCountermeasures.com for your free hour-long video.
Okay, we're back with Patricia, and we were talking about Twitter. So, okay, the big question for you, if I'm following 300 people and I'm following their followers and they got all of this stuff going on and I got the blog I'm supposed to write and I got Facebook I'm supposed to post to and I got a website I'm supposed to be on top of.
Right.
What am I supposed to do about running the company? Where do I find this time?
First off, I have what I call the 15-minute rule. And you should spend no longer than 15 minutes a day on social media, other than because if you are, you're wasting your time that could be better spent on exactly the things that you mentioned, on running a business, you know, doing your administrative work, you know, developing new clients, new business, you know, doing the, say, managing your team effort, you know, working with your staff, your employees. So how do you do that? How do you come up with, you know, how do you implement a 15-minute rule? Well, in my case, what I do is I connect my Facebook fan page is connected to my Twitter, which is connected to my LinkedIn, which is connected to the homepage of my website. So when I post once on my Facebook fan page, it's immediately posted across platforms. So that's one way that I save time. So I would say that once you get into it, you have to find ways to streamline what you're doing. And you have to train yourself, you know, not to get involved with it. Like everyone, you know, we're all human beings, so we go on, we see something, like one of your friends is doing something, you get curious. And to really limit yourself and to watch the clock while you're on there. Because other than that, then you're wasting your time.
And then you get caught up in the breaking news sort of stuff as well.
Yeah, and you have to monitor that, especially the two of you, because you're in media, so you have to see what's going on. And one thing that I have found Twitter to be extremely useful, it's a tool of what I would call competitive intelligence. I don't see it as a way to promote my business, or I don't see it a way necessarily to sell books for me or for my clients. The primary tool is I see it as a way to find out who else is out there and what they're doing. If you just use Google and search for something on Google, you're not going to find what you're looking for because there's so much out there and everyone's playing the SEO or search engine optimization game. and to stay on top of, to come up, you know, on the first page of search rankings. So you don't see what's really going on out there. But with Twitter, you see everything, the good, the bad, and the ugly. And I think that's where, you know, people can really benefit, because you can see what your competitors are doing and how they're positioning themselves.
How do you find marketing your book? Did you have a publisher, or did you self-publish?
The first book I wrote, called PR for People, is a guide or a primer for individuals to learn what tools to use to promote themselves and to build their brand. That I had was a self-published book, and then the two subsequent books were with a published small independent publisher. And the first book, I strictly was in print, and the PR for People book, and I'm just bringing that up now to it'll go in the next month, will be an ebook as well. And if I had to do it over again, I would never do a print run on a book, because they have to be stored and you have to deal with distribution, and I would only go with print on demand and as an ebook. And print on demand gives you it's very cost effective now, and it's high speed printing, so there isn't any delay in getting those books out when there's a request for them.
There was actually a story on 60 Minutes talking about that, where Amazon can have the book printed in something like 3 to 4 hours from the time you make the order.
Isn't that amazing how far we've come in publishing?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, I started in my favorite job before I had my own business. I was on the management team. I was the vice president of communications for a digital publisher called Publishing Online. And that was in the late 90s, and that was pre-Kindle and pre-Nook and pre-iPad. And back in the day, we didn't really have good e-book reading devices. So it was like we were really the first to go out there and wear our heads on pikes, so to speak, because we digitized books that were in print, or we published first-time authors. But the e-book reading devices they had then were not good at all.
You know, it's funny how things. I remember that company, and I thought, I do a lot of work in the printing industry. I remember that company, and it's typical. Pioneers get the arrows in their backs.
That's right.
That went on. Let's go quickly to cooking. You told me you cook two, your gravy. Wait a second. What do you call that red?
I hear people call it gravy, but I call it sauce, and my husband calls it sauce. And I make a 16-gallon pot of sauce every month and freeze it. And because we use it for so many different kinds of pasta dishes, you know, ravioli. On special occasions, I always make manicotti, or as my husband and my father say, manicot. You know, and yeah, and I don't think there's anything unusual about my sauce. It's just I use 8 to 10 pounds of sausage in it, and it has all the usual ingredients.
Where do you get Italian sausage in Seattle?
De Laurenti. It's in the market. And there's another place, Cacioppo Brothers, that they also have sausage. So those are the places, the best, because their sausage is a higher quality because it has anise in it, and it's nothing like the Calabria up on Arthur Avenue in the Bronx?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the real McCoy. In fact, when I was in New York in November, a friend of mine is Phyllis Corky she's the business editor for the New York Times, and we went up to Arthur Avenue on the weekend, and because to me, that's the real Italian neighborhood. You know, Little Italy's more touristy,
yeah.
And we had a great time, you know, going to the different places, and the people on the street, it was the funniest thing that happened is that I saw these three men standing around, and I said, Phyllis, they look like, you know, the those who know, and I said, can I take your photo? You know, I put up my phone, and one of them started running. He ran. He didn't want to be photographed. And I said, oh, boy. You know, they're probably in the witness protection program or something.
But one more quick thing. When you say the market in Seattle, you're referring to the downtown? What market?
That's the Pike Place Market.
Right. Okay.
And, yeah, I just love that place. My husband and I we live in Queen Anne. In Queen Anne, I'm sure you've seen all the postcards of the city of Seattle Space Needle. We're on the hill above the Space Needle, so quite often we'll walk down to the market and on the weekends, and it's about maybe a 20 minute to half hour walk from our home.
Is there a big Italian-American community out there?
No. In fact, for a long time, I mean, Rosella's Produce was a big company here, and Michael Rosella, who's the founder of that company, I always called him my Italian godfather in Seattle, and I met him at church. He was a wonderful man. I mean, he was like, he was the kind of person who was always giving everyone bags of fruits and vegetables, and he was just an incredible person. And the neighborhood that Michael grew up in is over in the south end of Seattle, and they had a little pocket down on off of Rainier Avenue called the Garlic Gulch, and that was the Italian neighborhood, and it doesn't really exist anymore. I mean, there aren't any Italians there, but most of the Italians I know in Seattle I have come to know through the Italian Club. I'm a member. And it's a social club. It's one of the oldest social clubs in the country. And the funny thing about it is that until 15 years ago, the men had to meet separately from the women. they couldn't be in the same room together. They had their own nights to meet and get together. So they've modernized now, and they actually allow women and men to be together.
But wait, who did the cooking then?
I know. They usually have someone cater it. I know, come in. Yeah.
Don and I belong to a club in New York called the Union League Club.
Oh, I know the Union League. I did an event there in 2007.
So how come you haven't done one since?
Come on, we could use
the business. How come you haven't done that?
I love that. It's beautiful. It's on Park, right around 32nd Street.
37th, yeah. 37th
yeah,
Park.
Yeah. It was for the Moran Media Group.
Okay.
It was a small business summit, so we had, press there. It was very.
Oh, you know Moran?
Yes, yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. I forget how I met him now.
It's unimportant. We have to talk offline this week.
Yeah.
But anyway, we have a lot more to talk about. I would love to talk about you say how Italian Americans help each other. It's very interesting. I have not found that as frequent as you do, and maybe it's my style or whatever. But I remember my local barber talking about the fact that when he was a young man, he bought a Cadillac. When he was just 23, and when he brought it in front of his uncle's house, his uncle told him to park it around the corner because the neighbors would get jealous.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting. Yeah, the Cadillac, the only thing I remember, my cousins, the Pelosi's, Junior Pelosi, I think was in trouble for loan sharking, and his brother, Joe Pelosi, this was back in, they all drove Cadillacs, they all drove big cars, and I remember this was the summer that, I was going away to college, and we went to get a U-Haul in South Yonkers, and it was the summer, I think, that Joey Gallo was how should I say, whacked.
And,
you almost said whack. Go ahead.
Whacked. Sorry.
You almost said whack. That's what
I know.
Out.
Yeah. And anyway, we were down South Yonkers, and my father saw Joe Pelosi, and he rolled down the window, and he beeped the horn and said, "Hey, Joe," and Joe ducked. He ducked. And I thought that was really funny. I mean, because he ducked because there was a war going on in New York that summer, and I guess he thought that someone was trying to shoot at him. But they all drove cars like that, and that was kind of funny. there was a kind of a, back then, I mean, I think that things have changed dramatically since then.
And most of them gotten legitimate.
Right. Yeah.
So, Patricia, what are you working on today, or what are the things that are coming up in your world that you want the public to know about? What's the new programs you have that you're excited about?
Well, our website, we provide low-cost tools and services for clients so they can promote themselves. So we offer an electronic press kit that they can have all. It's like a professional dossier that they can have everything about them, but more importantly, they can put all their media clippings in it. And then we offer our media switchboard service, where we monitor a number of newswire services. And when we see something that fits our client, their expertise, or who they are, then we route that request to our client, and they can respond to it. So we vet, you know, looking for media requests that our clients, where they can get placed in the press. So that's one thing. We're really scaling that part of the business, and also getting the word out to journalists that if they are looking for someone, they're on deadline, and they need an expert, they need a source for a story, they can come to us as a first place, that they don't have to post on PR Newswire or on Harrow or any of the other outlets. They can come to us, and we'll find them the right person on deadline. And I'm getting more and more media who are doing that they're not posting, or they give up when they do, like if they post on Harrow, they might get 300 or 400 responses of people who aren't really qualified, so they'll come to us. And then the other thing is that we launched a digital magazine called PR for People, The Connector, and I had been wanting to do that for a long time, because it's a way that we can write about interesting things and feature our clients, and then the magazine is strictly digital, and I love the idea of being able to include video and podcasts, and, you know, the full range of media is in this magazine. And we just launched three so far. It's a quarterly. And the first issue was on thought leadership, and then the second issue was on money, so because I have a lot of clients who are wealth managers. And then the last issue is on beauty fashion, and we're getting ready. Our deadline for the next one is coming up, and it's on jobs. And it's called Jobs, The Coming War, Which Side Are You On? And we're looking at a lot of very interesting issues about, you know, the state of the economy right now, and, you know, how to get a job, and, you know, how a lot of young people coming out of college are just having a really tough time in seeking employment. So we have some guidelines for them. And the front cover is one of my clients. Her name is Anisha Vinja Murray, just stunningly beautiful Indian woman, and she's the CEO of her own company called Innovations IQ, which is a high-tech recruiter firm. So she places all the, we call them propeller heads, you know, in all the companies, and it'll be a really great issue. So we're looking to use this as a tool to send out to press, and right now, you know, we send it out to journalists all over the country. And if you're a client, you know, on that basic, you know, subscription level, then you automatically get featured in the magazine, you know, depending on the issue that we're covering.
You know, it's funny. I produce an online magazine, too. It's amazing how much we have in common. But what is a propeller head?
That's a geek, a developer.
Okay.
Web developers, yeah.
Why do you call them propeller head? I've never heard that expression, but it's very, very graphic.
Yeah, it's because that's what they do best. They just go in there and they code, and they don't really do anything else. So that yeah.
It's very interesting. If I'm a journalist, if I'm interested, how do I get to see a copy of your e-zine?
The best way, just to get in touch with me, and I'll put you on the list. And the next issue is coming out in May.
Mm-hmm.
And then the issue after that's on jobs. I mean, not on jobs. I mean, the next issue, the next one's on the June issue's on jobs, September issue's on books, on the book.
Oh, well, that one I definitely want to get involved. I've been trying to convince Sal to finish his book. He's got a terrific book, and I keep trying to get him to finish it, and he looks at me.
No, that would be great. Yeah, I'd love to see it because we've been putting on a book summit. This on August 1st in Seattle is our third annual Seattle Book Summit. So I'd love if you're out here, if you can make it to Seattle. It's that's the time of year when we have the most beautiful weather, and unbeknownst to a lot of people, it doesn't rain here all the time. And in the summer, it's like San Diego weather. It's sunny and hot during the day, no humidity, and it cools down at night. So
Tell me a little about the book summit. What's that about?
What we'd like to do is it's not a place to sell books. It's a place for authors and publishers to learn best practices in order to promote their books. And so this year we have Wally Collins, the comedian and author. He's a New York City-based comedian. He's coming out. And one of my clients, Tim Gervin, from Tim Gervin Branding and Design, he'll be doing a talk on the human brand. And we have panels set up, and we cover everything from the state of publishing, you know, what's going on in the industry. You know, we ask questions like, should you self-publish? Should you get an agent, go the traditional route? What are the options, you know, for an e-book? What elements do you need? How to choose an editor, and, you know, the different types of editing, whether it's developmental editing, where you're actually having the editor help you write the story, or just straight copy editing. And then we also we talk about some of the things that are going on in publishing that a lot of authors and publishers may not be aware of, and how people are paying for play. You know, for example, there's a company now where if you pay them $35,000,
yes,
they'll go out and buy a ton of your books, and you'll be immediately bumped to the New York Times bestseller list. So different things like that, and then the whole practice of building what we spoke about earlier in building a fake Twitter community or a fake Facebook community. I know if you want to get a lot of fans on Facebook, that it costs about $2,500, and instantly you can get 10,000 fans. So people may not be aware of that. When you think of someone like Ashton Kutcher, you know, maybe he has 17 million followers on Twitter. Well, maybe he doesn't really. I mean, why does 17 million people really care about him?
I don't know if you're aware, Patricia, but I've helped develop a few books. In fact, one of our guests just got his contract for his book from a publisher through me.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, maybe you should. I'd love to invite you to the summit to be on the panel.
I would very much like to, because I've been doing this, and anyway, we'll talk offline. Well, let's not waste the reader's time. But more importantly, do you have any thoughts? We're getting close to the end. Do you have any final thoughts? Have you found happiness in Seattle? Would you eventually go back to the East Coast?
I always think of going back to New York. I mean, I always will be visiting, you know, a frequent flyer. And life is easier in Seattle. I mean, we don't have the high tax load that you have in New York. I mean, just the property taxes are astronomical, I think, in New York. And overall, it's much higher cost of living to live in New York City. And I guess if you don't care about money, and I do, I'm very, I'm frugal. Maybe that's my Sicilian nature. And I don't like to have to pay unnecessarily for what I need not do. So that would be an obstacle for me to go back to New York. And I think that living on the West Coast, it's an easier way of life. You know, it's... there isn't as much, I can't say crime, because there's an old adage about criminals on the East Coast and the criminals on the East Coast do it for the money, but the criminals on the West Coast are just crazy. So it's not that component, but it's just it's a nice way of life on the West Coast. So that I think I really like the combination, and that I wouldn't want to give up.
So you've answered the question. An Italian-American from New York can find happiness in Seattle.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, it's my family and my, you know, husband and my career, you know, so I love all those things, so.
And if people wanted to be able to find you online or to reach out to you, how does the audience get to you?
Yeah, I think that I have an email address set up for that. It's very easy to remember. It's just pr4people@gmail.com.
Is that
P-R-F-O-R.
Number four or the letter four?
Yeah. It's the spelling it out, pr4people.com. And that's the easiest way to reach me. And I'd love to hear from, you know, anyone who has questions about, you know, our business, you know, how we can help them, you know, how we can help them break through the clutter and to get high-quality media placement or media exposure. And also, if people are interested in our book summit in August, it's going to be held at the main branch of the Seattle Public Library. And it's a beautiful building that was funded in part by the Gates Foundation, and the architect is I.M. Pei. And it's the polar opposite of my beloved main branch public library on Fifth Avenue in New York.
I mean,
this is strictly postmodern, and the one in New York is just, it's incredible. So, and in fact, I think they both really speak to the differences between Seattle and New York. You know, that I don't think there's anything more beautiful than that main library in New York City. And then the one here in Seattle is very forward-thinking, clean, stark lines, lots of glass, lots of light. You know, so they're both good.
Okay, one final question with about 30 seconds to go. It's Sunday. What's for dinner tonight?
Tonight, it's my son's birthday. My son will be 28 tomorrow. So I'm actually cooking steak, and I'm teaching him. I'm giving him a little cooking lesson. So he wants to know. So no Italian food, unfortunately.
No Italian food.
Yeah, not
barbecue
tonight.
Time.
Yeah.
Well, Patricia, we really want to thank you for joining us today. It was fun getting to chat with you and talking about not only about the heritage and about growing up out in Seattle and the differences in New York, but appreciate your input on what businesses should be doing, at least trying to clear up some of the confusion in social media. So I personally enjoyed that part of our conversation.
Yeah, well, thank you. Well, I feel grateful to have been on the show and to know you guys. I mean, it's wonderful to know two more Italians who are, you know, doing a great thing in the world. So, and I hope to meet you in person very soon.
We'll look forward to that. Okay, when we come back, we're going to have our closing comments.
Okay, take care.
Many small businesses purchase supplies, equipment, other needs through local stores. To save money on many of these purchases, consider Deem.com. This purchasing site offers real bargains and large discounts on many key items needed to run your business. And it's free to join and use. That's Deem.com. Again, Deem.com for all your small business needs.
Okay, we're back. I'd like to thank our guest today, Patricia Vaccarino, for spending part of her day with us. I know being out on the West Coast, she had to get up early to sit around and chat with us, but we really appreciate that. Don, as we're closing out the show, I understand you're going to get to see Frank Santasola soon.
No, I understand you're going to go see him.
Oh, I thought he was coming into town to see you. Okay.
No, but whatever the case, Frank's a happy man right now. He's got his contract, and he's got everything moving. So
Miranda Rights has been picked up. Frank was one of the original guests that we had on American Italian Radio, and so we're real happy about it. And I couldn't be more proud about Frank and what he achieved in writing the book and, you know, sitting down and going through the process. So that was really good. What are you writing about, Don? Don't you have something? Don't you have a tune that you've been working on?
Oh, yeah, my book. In fact, I really got interested in that. Hopefully, I'm helping everybody else, but right now finding a publisher myself is proving more difficult. But who knows? I still want you to finish your book because it's great.
I can write my book, and then I can become my favorite Italian author
right.
if I get to finish the book.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Who is your favorite author?
Me.
Well, I'm going to put in a plug.
I don't write much, so it's me. Eventually, I'll get the book done one of these days, and then we can announce it here.
You got it.
All right, folks, we hope you enjoyed the show, and we'll share your enjoyment with your family and friends. As one of our past guests and a good friend, Ray Fiola, said on a recent show, you tell one Italian and you're telling Italy. So we hope to get someone who's interested in all things American-Italian to join us and listen to us weekly. We're here to keep our heritage alive and living and well-living in America. Please follow us on Twitter at USA Italian Radio. You can find us on Facebook at American Italian Radio. And you can also visit our website at AmericanItalianRadio.com. If you'd like to be a guest on our show, we ask you to please contact us through the website, AmericanItalianRadio.com, and fill in the information sheet there, and it'll come to Don and I, and we'd be more than happy to review it. For Don Mazzello and myself, I'd like to thank you for listening, and we hope to have you back real soon.
Thank you for listening to American Italian Radio, the Air Channel. We hope you've enjoyed today's program, and we look forward to you joining us again next week. Please follow us on Facebook at American Italian Radio and on Twitter at #USAItalianRadio.